We are in Exodus chapter 7. Going back to it. You know, it's a, I don't know that you call it a Christmas break because I don't know that there's such a thing. It's all about the Lord has come. It's all about the Redeemer is here. So, here we are continuing on in Exodus chapter 7. A couple weeks ago before Christmas, we talked about Moses and Aaron's, you know, confrontation with Pharaoh for the first time, and, you know, obviously he threw his staff down and became a serpent, and that was pretty impressive. And then the magicians did the same thing, threw their staffs down and became serpents, and, you know, Aaron's snake ate theirs, but, you know, Pharaoh's heart was still hardened. But I haven't forgotten about what you're talking about, why Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and plan to address that. The other day we began a conversation about, predestination and free will, basically. You know, in that, you know, did Pharaoh harden his heart or did God harden Pharaoh's heart? And what does that look like? You know, when you read it, there's actually three different words that are used in there for hardening of heart. Pharaoh's heart was hardened. And, you know, there would be an obvious question, which Paul confronts in Romans chapter 9, that, well, if God hardened Pharaoh's heart, then why does he have to be accountable for his heart being hard? And there's a pretty good dialogue about your man, he is God, shut up. But I am also under the, you know, at this point, I would be of the persuasion not to skirt it. You know, it's kind of like the Trinity. Can anybody explain to me the Trinity in a way that I can completely understand and simplify? Yeah, like an egg. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I know. I've heard a lot of pretty weak arguments of life, you know, here. The Trinity, it's one of those things, you know, God is God, and Jesus, and the Holy Spirit, the three individuals, but they're the same and they're one, and that doesn't make any sense to us finite mortals. Do I think that there's profit in pursuing that? Absolutely. Do I think there's profit in trying to understand that? Absolutely. Do I think that you would be suspect to end up on one side or the other in a very strong way? No, you're going to be in balance there because they're both true. And they're two principles that seem irreconcilable to us. They're coming together. They're three individuals and yet they're one and the same. You know, Jesus prayed to God. You know, he wasn't talking to himself in the mirror. You know, what does that look like? You know, doing it. I mean, it's one of those principles that is with finite, and it's not a cop out because the one who spends the most time pursuing and understanding that will have the most benefit of understanding more about God. Will you ever fully understand that? I think you would be a fool to think so. We're finite. I think it's somewhat the same way with predestination and free will. You know, I think that I don't want to make that into an egg either, you know, because that's or a three section orange or something, you know, doing it. I do know that God says both things, and so I know both are true. That man is without excuse. And I would contend that from a practical standpoint, that is really the most important thing in this room. I can be pretty convinced of something in this room, that everyone in here God has called. You know, everyone in this room right now, God has put in their hearts to know him better. What are you going to do with that? How are you going to respond to that? How are you going to deal with that? You don't get to go, well, I don't have a choice, or it's not up to me, or, God says, you know, it is up to you. So we have a responsibility to decide what we are going to do with God's call in our life. Just like Pharaoh did. You know, it's hard to read in there the way that it's translated at times, but there is a definite distinction in the book of Exodus. There is a distinction between Pharaoh, it is written, Pharaoh hardened his heart against God. But it is also written that God hardened his heart. You know, it would seem to me at this point, and well worth continuing and debating. You know, I read through Romans quite a few times in the last couple of weeks, you know, wanting to be in, try to explain something as a teacher that I honestly don't have a real good explanation for, or a real hard line on doing it. But it appears to me, and it seems like for at this point, for practical purposes, that God hardens, is willing to, and absolutely does, at his choice, hardens the heart of those who have chosen to harden their hearts. And those who make a choice to harden your heart against God, at some point are going to be outside of the grace of God and the mercy of God and the calling of God. It is God's choice who he calls, and that God uses circumstances around us to harden our hearts. We have Pharaoh here that God was absolutely intended to use for his purpose, to show his glory to the Israelites and to show his glory to the Egyptians, to show his glory to the world. And we have Pharaoh here whose heart God hardened. Says it. It's flat out, okay? I would suggest that there's there's a worse place to be in than a hardened heart. That is the most desperate state I believe that a human can exist in, is to have a hard heart towards God. So it would be something that all of us should reflect on in our lives, where and how and to what extent are our hearts hard. Truth is, there's a bit of hardness in all of our hearts. And the eradication of that is very important. How does that come? You know, how do you eradicate that? By honoring God as God, by honoring God as King. You know, you think, well, Moses or Pharaoh's heart, we need to understand Pharaoh's heart was already pretty hard. He believed he was God. He believed he was a God. Okay? That's a pretty hard heart towards God, the Yahweh, the God of the Bible. But Pharaoh asks a question, and, you know, to continue on where this is going, Pharaoh asked a question and said, excuse me, he said in chapter 5, verse 2, he asked a question that I would contend that in spite of the fact we think that we're pretty smart and we're pretty progressive and we're pretty advanced, I think every generation always thinks that, right? I think if you went back and looked at most every generation, they would all think that we're way smarter than that generation, right? We're way ahead of that generation. And in this generation, we think that we're, there's a movement. We even call it progressive movement. You know, what does this look like? This means that we're basically, I mean, it has a lot to do with, we're not basing our lives in truth or fact. We're basing our lives in what I feel. That my truth is my truth, and how I feel is how I feel. Politics has gone that way, but it goes that way with God too. It's how I feel about it is what my truth is, not objective truth, not objective reality. But the question of mankind, in spite of the fact that we might have, you know, made contraptions we can fly around in, or little things we can push buttons and it sends information all over the world, or little clouds we can store all the information of the world in, or whatever it might be, and we think we're so smart, Modern kids think they're so smart because they can play video games way better than their parents. So they think they're way smarter than their parents. It's always been that way. The truth is, man hasn't changed. Man still asks the same question that Pharaoh asks. And this is, it's important to learn the lessons and how God responds. Again, as we've talked from day one, the story of Exodus is a story about God drawing his people out of the world and God calling his people out of the world. That is no different than any of us. We are all in that same boat. That God is calling us out of Egypt, which represents the world. God is drawing us out of Egypt. Okay? So when we look at how God does that and what God does to do that with his people, it's applicable to our life because unfortunately we still ask the same question that Pharaoh did in chapter 2, or in chapter 5, verse 2. He says, Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice?" Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice? That is a question man has had since Adam and Eve. Right? Adam and Eve. Eve asked that question, right? Satan asked that question to her, and she went along with it. Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice? She said, don't eat of this tree, but, you know. Same. We're in the same place. Our decisions, our lives are based on an understanding of that or an answer to that. What did God respond to that in? He said, okay, you've called me God Almighty. This wasn't an odd thing to, you know, their society in Egypt is actually much like ours. You know, they were a pantheistic society. They believed, they had like 114 gods they served. Okay? So a new God of Israel was not like something new, right? I mean, this is, we would expect you to have a God. You know, there's gods for everything. It was like a bunch of different gods. Something that was, and don't understand. You know, the thing that we need to understand, there's a very, very dangerous stage that we are in as a culture in that the modern church, Christianity, in for a long time has lost sight and doesn't believe in spiritual things. And so, you know, conservative evangelicalism went to a very intellectualized relationship with God. And if I understand the Bible, if I understand intellectually what is right, then that means I'm right with him. And that's a ridiculous statement, okay? God is spirit, and you will worship in spirit and truth, or you will not worship him. So what's happened is that we tend to, whenever we see supernatural that has the characteristics, maybe looks kind of like, replicate something like God, we attribute it to God. How did that go with the miracles that they did? How'd that go with when they threw the staff down and this, you know, it became a serpent? That was a miraculous thing. What did Pharaoh's magicians do? Threw their staffs down and they became serpents. You know, it's why Paul says it tests the spirits. Because something is supernatural and looks like it's good or looks like it's right, doesn't mean that it is. And so Pharaoh asked the question that we all ask. We were talking earlier. I read that only about 3%, 3-point-something% of our society, of our world, not of our world, of our society, of the United States, Americans, who are truly atheistic. I don't even know if they are, you know, because I think a lot of atheists are just really pissed off, you know, about God. But there's only 3% that are even that. They're a very vocal minority, make a lot of noise, want to tear down statues and crosses and do all kinds of stuff doing it. But, so that means 97% of people believe in a God in this country. Okay? Now, because we, of the nature of our country, to some degree, they would say it's all the same God, right? Everybody would say, we all believe in the same God. Mormons would say they believe in the same God. Jehovah's Witnesses would say they believe in Catholics. Everybody would say they believe in the same God. Even within the church, we'd say we all believe in the same God. If somebody says, believe in God, you go, oh, you're a Christian. Really? You know, the enemy replicates, impersonates, substitutes himself for the true and living God. His question, who is this God? Who is this God that I should let these people go? I want to know who you are. And God's response was, I am who I am, right? He says, you've always called me the great one, the powerful one doing that. But now my name is Lord. My name is, which means I am who I am. I be who I be, but that doesn't translate so well. The word is I am who I am. Okay? So, in other words, I'm not who you make me out to be. I'm not who you want to think I am. I'm not who you make me up to be. Because the truth is that the enemy is very good at saying, okay, what do you want your God to be like? I'll be like that. You want him to be nice, not too scary, you know, kind of suggest some good things in life and lead you down a good way. But, you know, if you decide, you can always say, hey, hold on a minute. I'm doing this. Do you want to make up a God? The one thing, we're all good with God, right? Until it's a God, this is what we're supposed to do. Right? Until it's a God that imposes on our will. Until it's a God that says, I demand everything in your life. I don't like that God so much. You know? I mean, I'm good with God. You know? I was good. I mean, as a kid, what a pathetic thing that my parents let me watch. But I Dream a Genie? Sweet, man. I want one of those, okay? When I need something, you know, let's just rub a little lamp and beautiful girl comes out and give me what I need, you know, supernatural kind of doing it. Most of us, on some degree, have a view of God like that. He's there when I need him. When I don't, he's fine. He can kind of hang. You know, he's got lots to do. He's busy, right? But when I need him, you know, he's there. He's there for me. If I need comforting, if something goes really bad, if I really get in a jam, I need some help out doing it. But imposing his will on me, well, I don't know what he really says. I don't know what he really means. We can't really know. All of a sudden, we say, that's not the God that I serve, that he demands our lives absolutely, completely. Okay? Because I don't like that one. I'm doing it right. It goes against our will. So we create gods. And again, churches are full of people who believe in gods than the God of this Bible. The God of this Bible, and that's how we know. Does the fruit of your life look like the fruit that says will be from a relationship with the God of this Bible? So Pharaoh is asking the same question that we all ask, that mankind has always asked, who is this God? And God says, okay, I'll show you who I am. I'm going to show you who I am. This was necessary for not only the Egyptians and for Pharaoh. Pharaoh was just in a right here, thinking he's God, and it's not going to go well for him, okay? But also the Israelites, okay? The Israelites were 400 years in captivity, and they'd held on to a remnant, okay? But for 400 years, they had been in the midst of this 114 different gods, people that worship. They worked in houses, they worked as slaves, they worked as... And they were in the midst of this. You know, when they first came, God led them in a miraculous way. And what an amazing thing. They were living out in an ugly desert. And it was the worst drought ever. And they were dying and their sheep were dying and nothing was going to go well. And they were all going to die. And Joseph brought them into Egypt. And they were given the best land of Egypt, the land of Goshen. Okay? The best land for grazing. And Egypt was an extremely rich, fertile, flourishing place. Okay, the Nile River provided water, provided fish, provided sustenance, provided minerals, provided rich soil for them to grow things, wheat and food and stuff. It was a very rich, first, flourishing place to the extent that the Egyptians were the wealthiest people on the face of the earth at the time and probably one of the most powerful, okay? So they were invited in, the Israelites were invited in, Joseph and all his family, to there and given the best of the land. And I'm sure that for a remnant, for a generation or two or three maybe, they went, God has done this for us. God has saved us. God has miraculously intervened. I mean, I'm sure the whole Joseph story didn't go away quickly, right? I mean, that's a wild story, right? He's sold into slavery and then he ends up being second only to the Pharaoh in the whole land of Egypt. And as a result, they are completely blessed and given prospering hugely. But as most of us do, I'm sure that on some level that means they kept a remnant, they kept a people. You know, what did it say about Moses' parents? We don't hear too much about him. We don't hear much about anything that happened. Joseph died. Lots of 100 years went by. Okay. And all of a sudden we hear about this guy whose parents said, we fear God, who was said of his parents, they feared God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, more than they feared the Pharaoh, more than they feared the gods of Egypt on doing it. Sweet. There was a remnant that they passed down for a long time. Do you think their view of God was skewed, though? Absolutely. Do you think it was somebody they were really willing to trust? No, they weren't. So God said, I am going to show who I am. Not who you make me up to be, not who you want me to be. I'm going to be who I am. And so when we look at the way that he came hard against Pharaoh, the way that he showed himself, this is what God's doing. So we pick up in chapter 7, verse 14. There's actually quite a bit. I hope to get well into 8, but let's see. Then the Lord, we didn't sing, so we got lots of time, right? Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is stubborn. He refuses to let the people go. Go to Pharaoh in the morning as he is going out to the water and station yourself to meet him on the bank of the Nile. And you shall take in your hand a staff that was turned into a serpent, the staff that was turned into a serpent, and you will say to him, the Lord. You want to know, you ask the question, Pharaoh, who is this God that I should let your people go? The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, and again, he uses that word, the Lord. I am who I am, has sent me, and I am who I am, says to you, let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness. But behold, you've not listened till now. I bet that was going well, right? Here's Moses telling the Pharaoh, the man who has ultimate authority over life, who is considered a god. Okay? You have not listened to now. Thus, none of us like to hear that even, do we? And we're not even Pharaoh, right? You've not listened well. So, he says, thus says the Lord, by this you will know that I am the Lord. Behold, I will strike the water that is in the Nile with the staff that is in my hand, and it shall be turned to blood. And the fish that are in the Nile will die, and the Nile will become foul, and the Egyptians will find difficulty in drinking water from the Nile. Then the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, take your staff and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over the rivers, over the streams, over the pools, and over all the reservoirs of water, that they may become blood. And there shall be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, both in vessels of wood and in vessels of stone. So Moses and Aaron did, even as the Lord had commanded, and he lifted up the staff, struck the water that was in the Nile, in the sight of Pharaoh, and in the sight of the servants. And all the water that was in the Nile was turned to blood. And the fish that were in the Nile died, and the Nile became foul. The Egyptians. And the blood was through all the land of Egypt. But the magicians of Egypt did the same with their secret arts, and Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them, as the Lord said. Then Pharaoh turned and went into the house with no concern even for this. So all the Egyptians dug around the Nile for water to drink, because they could not drink the water from the Nile. 7 days passed after the Lord struck the Nile. You know that, in spite of the fact that it probably seems like the story we heard when we were kids in Sunday school, right? And it harkens back to a day of that, or maybe we watch the epic movie, Moses or something on TV and saw it, you know, and that is a striking thing. That was very impressionable for me as a kid, you know, because now all of a sudden you have this, and, you know, Charlton Heston wasn't Moses, but, you know, that's the impression we have of him doing it. This is something that seems like something distant story, doesn't have a lot of relevance. I would contend that this is God in his mercy showing that their gods were not the true gods, were not him, were not the true and living gods, that these were impersonators. The God, it's interesting, the God of, it just happens to be, I think, but the God of the Nile was called Happy. H-A-P-I, I would like, not H-A-P-P-Y, but H-A-P-I, okay, was called Happy. And it was the God, the Nile represented what to the Egyptians? It represented life, right? It represented what brought life to their, what brought community, what brought joy, what brought celebration, because it was the life source was the Nile. And as a result, this demonic impersonator, okay, named Happy, who was this, girl, lots of gods were girls doing it, but this god, goddess of the Nile, was somebody they worshipped and paid homage to. So it's probable that when Pharaoh was going down to the water, like he did every day doing it, it was a worship time of going into the water and paying homage to the source of happiness, the source of life. Okay? The source of what the wellspring of life was the Nile. And God said, no, that's not the truth. The truth is that is not the wellspring of life, that I am the wellspring of life. There's a necessary correction continuously, but there's a necessary correction in all of our lives when we ask the question, who is this God? And we, you know, we would say, well, we wouldn't worship some stupid God named Happy that we, you know, said, you know, was the source of life doing it, you know. Yes, we would. You know, we by nature all have a strong bent to move towards worshiping the created rather than the creator. I've heard it put like, and I believe it's a very apropos thing, turning a good thing into a God thing. We contend that that's the baseline of idolatry. It's turning something good into a God thing. You know, how does this, you know, again, we tend to disassociate ourselves, but man hasn't changed. What do we look at? What is our source of life? What will make us happy? What will bring us joy? You know, when we're kids or when we're growing up, as we grow up, we come up with these objectives. Like married, you know? Now, marriage is from God, right? Marriage is a good thing. But we have this idea, if I marry this right girl, if I marry this right guy, I'm going to be happy. I'm going to be full of joy. My life will be content. My life will be complete. If I have this certain car, if I earn this, if I have this job where I earn this X amount of money, I will be happy, right? And you say, well, yeah, but we don't worship. Really? What do you sacrifice to that? What do you give to that? What energy and party life do you pour into that with the hope that that thing will bring happiness into your heart, into your life? And anybody who says they haven't done that is a liar, right? We all by nature do that and put it up there. The sweet thing about this, just like the sweet thing about God, is that God's mercy shows us and allows the world, allows circumstances to show us that isn't true. Have any of us who were married realized that it wasn't what we thought it would be? Yeah. Well, this was going to bring me happiness. This is going to bring me joy. Now we can say, well, but I married the wrong person. This person, like, if it wasn't for him, I would be. If it wasn't this. Marriage is not going to bring... All of us want happiness, right? All of us want joy. All of us want peace, contentment, security. God knows. Those are necessary things in our lives for to be happy, to have joy, to have peace, to have security in our lives. Those are necessary things. But we look at things as idolaters. We look at things that will make it. If I get this job and I make X amount of money, I'll be happy. Have you ever known anybody who met that goal was happy? Or content? There's always another rung. I thought it would be, but it wasn't quite there. I just need to get here. I just need to get here. I just need to make this much more, right? Or how about that car, you know? If I end up with this car, right? I mean, I have a feeling. If I get a razor, I'd be happy, man. I mean, what more could a boy want in life, right? Turbo razor, yeah. What happens when you get the razor? All of a sudden you happy? Uh-uh. What happens when you get that car? Pretty soon it's like it's a car. There's nothing wrong with working hard and getting that car. When I have a house, when I live in a certain neighborhood, when I have this kind of house like this, then I'll be happy. There's nothing wrong with having that house in and of itself. There's nothing, obviously nothing wrong with marriage. But to think that is what's going to bring life to you is a false idol. That's not God is the giver of life. And it's only in Him that we will know life and know it abundantly. Jesus said, I came to bring life and to bring it abundantly. Jesus, a relationship with God, a right relationship with God is the source of life. And anything beyond that is a false idol that we tend to go. And God in His mercy was showing His people. Now you say, well, the people of Israel, it didn't take them, you know, you think, well, they did believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right? But they believed in other gods too. I mean, what happened in the wilderness pretty quick? Right? They made this golden calf thing. I mean, we go, oh, are you kidding me? How could they do that? You know? They had an idol in their lives? Yeah. That needed eradicating. And God was in the purpose saying, no, I am the giver of life. Not the Nile. Not the deity of the Nile. Not what you guys make up to be that's going to bring happiness, joy, and contentment in your life. It's not going to do it. I am the giver. In His mercy, God displays that. I am the one that brings life. Not the Nile. Because here's this death smell. I mean, that went on for apparently a week or so, right? All the fish die. This is what they eat. They couldn't drink it, you know. I mean, there was times when the Nile was high flood waters and it was tainted, colored from the red clay sand in Africa, you know, doing it. But it's still drinkable. It was still drinkable water. It says it wasn't drinkable doing it. And all the water everywhere. It wasn't just the Nile. I mean, so they were having to dig holes and doing it and go, wow, you know. The Nile isn't the source of our life. It is God shows Himself to be more powerful than the source of life. Let's move on. In chapter 8, verse 1, then the Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go that they may serve me. But if you refuse to let them go, behold, I will smite your whole territory with frogs. And the Nile will swarm with frogs, which will come up and go into your houses and into your bedrooms and on your bed and into the houses of your servants and on your people and into your ovens and into your kneading bowls. It's kind of like everywhere. And the frogs will come upon you and your people and all your servants. And the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your hand with your staff over the rivers, over the streams, and over the pools, and make frogs come up on the land of Egypt. So Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came up and covered the land of Egypt. And the magicians did the same thing with their secret arts, making the frogs come up on the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron and said, entreat the Lord that He may remove the frogs. These frogs really got to him, right? They would me too. You know, your frogs crawling on your face. And whenever you hold them, maybe it's mainly toads, but man, when you hold them, they always pee on you, you know, doing it on it. I mean, it's just gross, man. They're just, And, you know, a few and a few chop frogs chirping, you know, off in the cattails over there. Cool. In my food, in my kneading bowl, in my cupboard, in my bed, you know, this is, it obviously got to him, okay? He realized this is not going well. He called for Moses and Aaron. He said, entreat the Lord that he may remove the frogs from me and from my people, and I will let the people go, that they may sacrifice to the Lord. Well, okay, this is having the desired effect. And Moses said to Pharaoh, the honor is yours to tell me, when will I entreat for you and your servants and your people that the frogs be destroyed from you and your houses, that they may be left only in the Nile? Then he said, tomorrow. So he said, okay, may it be according to your word, that you may know that there is no one like the Lord our God. And the frogs will depart from you and your homes and your servants and your people. They will be left only in the Nile. Then Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh, and Moses cried to the Lord concerning the frogs which he had inflicted upon Pharaoh. And the Lord did according to the word of Moses, and the frogs died out of the houses and the courts in the field, so that they piled them in heaps, and the land became foul. But when Pharaoh saw that there was relief, he hardened his heart. This is a very important verse here, because this is something that we should all be incredibly careful of and have all done. But when he saw that there was relief, he hardened his heart and did not listen to them as the Lord had said. The god of the frog, that was another god of theirs that they trusted in. Her name was Heket. And she was this beautiful, gorgeous woman with a face of a frog. I don't know why they, I guess Buddha's ugly. I don't know what you do. You know, just something about it, you know, that wasn't, she had a face of a frog. And she was the god, goddess, the god that they worshipped, that they bowed down to, that they sacrificed to. She was the god of fruitfulness. She was the god of success. Sacrificing to her brought fruitfulness and success. Okay? And that's what they believed. That's obviously a lie. You know, we have lots of things in our lives that we think will fill our soul with fruitfulness and success. But the Bible talks about fruitfulness a lot, right? In the New Testament, it talks about the fruit of the Spirit, and the New Testament talks about the fruitfulness of people's lives. In fact, the Bible is pretty clear to talk about the way that we can know distinctively if somebody truly is a son or daughter of the true and living God is by the fruitfulness of their lives. And he says that you're to look at that, you know, and see. Because we can know that. We can know by the fruit that's produced what's there. But the only fruitfulness that will last comes from obedience and surrender to God. And we have lots of things that we think will produce fruitfulness. We have lots of things that we think will bring, you know, exercising, you know, working harder at our jobs, things, you know, that we think will bring us success and fruitfulness in our lives. I could have quit playing with this. Stick it in my hand. Excuse me. But there's only one thing that we should look at and desire for fruitfulness in our lives. Again, good things becoming God things is a very important thing to know. You know, I said that there's a lot of us, I grew up thinking that life would be complete and I would be happy. I was married. I mean, since about this big, I wanted to be married, you know, in doing it. It did not go the way I thought it would go. Okay? There was nothing that has kicked my fanny as hard as being married. I would contend still does. Okay? That's a good thing. That's a bad thing. There's also nothing in my life that brings more joy. There's nothing in my life that brings more happiness and contentment and peace There's nothing that brings more security than my relationship with my wife. But man, it's tough. I'm doing it. Marriage is a good thing. But I don't look for life to come from marriage. My sense of worth, my sense of value, my sense of being, my happiness, my contentment is not my marriage. Okay? That comes from my relationship with God. I am blessed by my marriage. And through that marriage, God does this. Like, does God use the river, the Nile River, to produce water, to grow crops, and put fertilized ground there and have fish in there so people have sustenance and they can eat? Yeah. Is that a good thing? That's a good thing. Is it a God thing? It's not a God thing. It's not something that we surrender to. It's not something we give our lives to. And God is merciful enough to expose our hearts, to expose what we serve that is not Him, that is other than Him, that keeps us blinded and keeps us from serving Him. The Pharaoh's heart is something that easily happens to a lot of us, right? I get fired. You know, whatever. You know, somebody gets fired. You get fired from your job, okay? Man, what do? Cry out to God. God, help me, right? God, I need your help. I need you to come alongside me. You know, we don't have enough money, or car crashes, or, you know, house through, whatever it might be that happens. It's a disastrous thing in our life. That God, in His, I would call it severe mercy, allows to happen in our life in order for us to realize our need for Him. But what so often happens when we finagle things and go to the dealership and talk the guy into giving us a loan, get another car, now I got a new car and I'm okay. I get a new job, you know, things are going better with my family, you know, my marriage isn't on the rocks so much, you know, I get some counseling. What easily happens? Who do we forget? Does that level of recognition of our necessity of dependence mean the same? Or do we, when a reprieve comes in our life, when we can breathe under the weight of whatever life is giving us, do we forget about God, go on about our life? It's a propensity in all of us, okay? Just like Pharaoh. Okay, all of a sudden he had frogs crawling all over him. It's terrible. There's frogs in his bed. And frogs, you know, can you imagine a little frog crawling on you, little sticky little feet? And stuff? It was bad. But when they went away, I don't know. I'm not lots of gods to serve. I'm not going to give allegiance and alliance to this God. And give up my life for this God. We all have a propensity to do this. So it keeps up, okay? It keeps up. So, then the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your staff, strike the dust of the earth, that it may become gnats through all the land of Egypt. I don't know, nobody seems to know quite what the Hebrew word for gnat means, you know. They all end up about the same. Some would interpret it as lice. Some interpret it as mosquitoes. And some interpret it as gnats. Okay? They all have about the same result, okay? When they're crawling all over you. Okay? And doing it. Okay? So, and they did so, and Aaron stretched out his hand with his staff and struck the dust of the earth. And there were gnats on the man and beast. All the dust of the earth became gnats through all the land of Egypt. And the magicians tried with their secret arts to bring forth gnats, and they could not. So there were gnats on man and beast. Then the magician said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. But Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them, as the Lord had said. You know, to me, the gnats are, one thing about, Egypt. When you see pictures of Egypt, you know, when you see old, because we have pictures still from Egypt that they drew at the time and things they did on it. This is about luxury and comfort, right? Comfort and peace. They weren't at war any of the times that we know of them, very often doing it. They're very powerful. They weren't at war. But picture you have with it, you know, they're reclining and they've got somebody waving a fan thing on them or something because it's really hot, right? And wouldn't look good in the pose, but you know, they're back reclining on something, and they lived a life of luxury and peace. How would that look laying down, reclining on the thing if you had lice all over you? Or mosquitoes relentlessly all over you? Or even gnats, little teeny gnats that... Right? Peace and comfort were something that they felt that the gods gave them. And God was coming hard against the fact that the only the creator of the soul can comfort the soul. And the peace that God promises to give, that Jesus promised to give, is a peace that surpasses all understanding. That's what we all want, right? All of us, you know, we don't mind the temporary euphoric feeling of eating a bowl of ice cream or something. I don't know what, you know? That this feels really good. I feel really content for a moment. But none of us are confused to think this is going to last very long, right? You know? We all like the euphoric feeling that we can momentarily gain in doing something. But what do we really want? Mankind longs for a peace that surpasses understanding, that is not contingent or based on circumstances, physical state, right? Peace and joy in the midst of whatever. In the midst of good times, in the midst of bad times, in the midst of hard times, in the midst of riches and plenty, that it is not contingent on circumstances or things around us. Is there anybody that doesn't want a peace and a joy in that? A sense of comfort, a sense of security that is not based on outside things? All of us want that. You know, we tend to look to temporary things to give us those, food, alcohol, you know, whatever level we take it to, success, money. Money's, right? Money in our culture, we think that will bring me peace, that will bring me security, that will bring me happiness, that will bring me something that will be long-lasting and enduring and I can hold on to and is good. Why are billionaires then always miserable? I mean, that's like a lot of money. That's like a lot of money. It's become, we toss it around these days, right? Because there's a lot of them. It used to be when I was a kid, it was millionaires. You know, somebody was a millionaire, they were like, you know, and now everybody in Seattle thinks they could be a millionaire, you know, doing it because there's, you know, it's common. Oh, million. So what? You know, is it? What I just read in a newsfeed, something about some guy that was a social worker and saved up all his life savings, so he ended up giving $11 million to children's charities at the end of his life, you know. He's a social worker doing it. I don't know where he came up with the money. I didn't read the article, you know, doing it. But now it's not. But a billionaire, that's like a whole lot more than a millionaire even. So it should be really, 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 really happy, right? Really, 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 really content. Really, really, really at peace. I've only known a couple personally. They're not happy. They were not happy. You know, in the old days, it was millionaires the same way. That was a pretty happy dude, wasn't it? You know? When we were kids, he was known as the richest man. You know, Howard Hughes, you know, he was the richest man. Not too happy. Not too at peace. Not too content on doing it. But yet, we still have this illusion, right? We still have this amazing illusion. that if I just had a little more, I would be happy. I would have comfort. I would have peace. Everybody in here has that, in their flesh, has that thing. Well, then I wouldn't have to worry, or then I wouldn't have to worry for the future, or then I could pay my bills off, or then I wouldn't pay interest. But the reality is, and then I would be at peace. But it doesn't matter. I mean, this valley is absolutely full of it, you know? I mean, I would, you know, I don't know, I'd like to think about $100 in the bank, but if I had money, you know, if I just could make $100,000, if I had $100,000, oh my gosh, I could get the turbo, you know, doing it. I would be happy, okay? I mean, but for most of us kind of go, well, not really, not 100, maybe 250. Yeah, now 250, now that $250,000, yeah, that would be a little bit better. Somebody has $250,000, are they going, yeah, I'm happy, this is a good spot, man. What do they say? No, if I had $1,000,000. If I had $1,000,000, then I could be happy doing it. Never ends. Never ends. Money is a false way to find comfort and peace, life and joy, or any of those things. And God was, I do not believe God was just randomly. He was trying to teach Israel, he was trying to teach Egypt, he was trying to, you know, it was a pawn in the deal. Who he was, who I am. I'm the giver of life, okay? I'm the source of life, not denial. I'm the giver of fruitfulness and success, and a life that's blessed with that, with productivity and success. I'm the God of comfort. I'm the God of peace. Not this world and not the things you have and what's around you. I'm the only one that can bring those things. And I encourage us all. I mean, it's New Year's, right? Coming up. And we talked over the years at different times about what that looks like and, you know, I don't see great value. In fact, I never did, even as a young kid that was pretty rebellious and getting stupid drunk and then going, now I'm going to have a New Year's resolution, never do this again. So next New Year's, and then I'm going to do it again, and I'm New Year's resolution, not do this again. You know? I mean, it's kind of a ridiculous thing. Who after a severe hangover doesn't go, I'm never doing that again? Everybody does that. I'm sure none of you have ever been that way, but me neither, but that's what I heard. I believe that there is some value and some merit in, at some point in your life. I don't care if it's, for me, it's during the fall, during hunting season when I'm out alone and in the mountains, but, you know, that didn't happen this year much, so I'll have to make a New Year's or something, but there is time of making the count. You know, of looking at what is it that I look for life? What is it that I think will bring me life? What is it? All of us want to be fruitful. All of us want to be productive. What is it that I think will look and feel fruitful and productive in my life? What is that marker that I put there? You know, and where will I know comfort and peace? Where will I know what is going to bring? And it's really good to evaluate all those things and to eradicate idolatry from our lives. You know, we have this generic word that we all believe in God in here. I'm confident everybody in here would say, I believe in God, right? Anybody who doesn't believe in God in here? I didn't think so. Believe in God, right? But that's like a great, unfortunately, a great big basket, or maybe garbage for the most part, you know? Who is this God you believe? Does it align? Is this the God, truly the God of the Bible? Is this I am who I am? Or is it different gods that we worship that we make up? Because we all, it's very easy to serve things other than the true and living God. And if we serve things other than the true and living God, we're idolaters. We serve false gods. Reality of it. That doesn't mean we don't go to work. Doesn't mean we don't get married. Doesn't mean we don't buy a car. Those aren't bad things in and of themselves. But are those things that we depend on for happiness and joy and peace? And are those things that we serve? Because serving something always means at the expense of others, right? God says, if you serve me, what does he say? You'll be hated. You're going to give up being adored by everyone in the world. Jesus said it. So, oh no, if I'm a good Christian, they're going to look up to me and think what a good guy you are. You know, everybody's going to respect me. Are you kidding? I am God. I never wronged anyone. They hated me. Who do you think you are? Is what he said. Who do you think you are? You think you're better than me? You know, why do you think people were like you when they didn't like me, when I didn't do anything wrong ever on doing it? What are we going to give up because of who we serve? Are we going to give up this world? Are we going to give up Egypt? This was a process that God was taking them, and he takes us all in. We all need to keep this in check. I would count that we're at different places in this room. I don't know some of you I do, where we're exactly are in place. But the process is God drawing us out of Egypt. God showing us who we are. It's who he is. And who we are. But showing us who he is. Showing what it means to follow him. Showing what his character, what his nature is. He said that. He goes, man, we could have gone straight over to the promised land like this. Boop. Actually, from your guys' perspective, boop, right here. Okay. But instead, he went clear down Sinai. Through the desert. Wandering for a long time. Okay? Ugly. Stressful. Why? He says, because I wanted you to know who I am, and I wanted you to fear me, so that when I finally said, in order to enter the promised land, you're going to have to lay your life down. In order to enter the promised land, which represents us, being born again, which represents us, being eternal beings with a life spent with God, to becoming saved. In order for that to happen, you're going to have to cross this raging Jordan River and confront the giants and the warriors and the massive cities. And I want you to fear me more than them. What was the net of that? We'll get to that story, but what was the net of that? Seven of them went back to Egypt. Wanted to go back to Egypt. Said, let's go back to Egypt. There's leeks and onions by the Nile. Right? We want to go back. I was serving a God, but I didn't realize you'd require everything of me. I thought you were just going to give me. I thought you were just going to give me the promised land. You said, there's houses, there's orchards, there's fields planted, everything's already in place, I'm just going to give it to you. And you thought, okay, I could just walk in and give it to me, you can eradicate me. He says, no, you're going to have to take it. You're going to have to lay your life down for that to happen. And when God requires it, when we realize that's a requirement to have a right relationship with God and enter the promised land, if you don't go, really? Then you're not really counting the cost. You don't go, and I would contend, this isn't necessarily just a once time. There is a time when I think we come to full surrender. Everything in our being that we know of is fully surrendered to God. Any of you become perfect at that moment? Mm-mm. Because then God will go, great, you're all in, 100%. Let's go. How about this tomorrow? How about that next day? And the process is, when I'm born again, when I'm led by the Spirit of God, what happens? I surrender my whole life to you. It's not my own. I'm glad you didn't put it all on the table the first time. You know? Might not have gone. You know, just like he said to them, glad they didn't see the giants before they left Egypt, right? They wouldn't have gone. Right? Just like us. But God's a merciful God and says, okay, just trust me. Be willing to lay your life down. Be willing to die. And let's go. If you know the God of the Bible, if you've been serving the true and living God of the Bible, not the golden calf, God of the life, not the gods of this world, happiness, success, money, home, children, wives, family, whatever. If those aren't the gods you've been serving the true and living God. You've come to know who I am. It won't lay your life down. Because you can trust me. Because you know I'm a good God. You know I'm a good Father. God in His mercy. I'll leave with this. The Puritans had a word, and I think that it's a very important, good word. It's called severe mercy. You know, we tend to look at life as if God's a good God. We parent this way too. If you're a good parent, then you'll be nice to your kids. And your kids will really like you. That means that you'll do good things to your kids, and they'll really like you doing it. God's severe mercy will always hurt. Well, it's mercy. It's kindness. It's the love of God that will hurt. Okay? Why? Because God loves us. God allows difficulty. He allows suffering. He allows loss. He allows pain, tragedy in our life to lead us to realize our need for God, to serve the true and living God, not the false God that's going to disappoint, not the golden calf or happy, the God of the Nile or the frog face God or whatever it might be. We would never be so stupid to do that, I know, but we have plenty of other gods in our culture that we worship. Look at the lives of people and what do they worship? You know, it is by where you pour your life into, by what you sacrifice for, by what you give to, is where you spend your money. You know, who's your God? Well, who do you spend the money on? You know, God says that. He says that's pretty clear in what that looks like. That I'm not telling anybody to quit paying your house payment, but because it probably ought to be done. You know, probably ought to be responsible. But it is who we serve. What is our life consumed by? The severe mercy, and this is something I thought I want to leave you with. Just like God put gnats, put frogs all over, put no water, turn all the water to blood. I mean, the blood stank and smelled foul. The fog stank and smelled foul. The whole land smelled foul. Can you imagine piles of dead frogs in 100 degrees? Not good, you know, or more, yeah, on doing it. I mean, it's just, the foulness of those things, the futility of those things. What did that mean? The people suffered. They were disappointed. They were bummed. They struggled. It was hardship. Did God do it because He was just going, "You're bad, I'm going to put a pile of dead frogs in your life"? No. God said, "I'm going to show you the futility of what you worship. That it is not the true and living God because I want to have a relationship with you." I've spoken in the process of dealing with some, over the last years, with some extreme abuse in childhood and growing up in lives of people. And my, you know, the tendency, the propensity, because let's be real honest. What is our tendency in our flesh? What is our tendency as humans to do when we're disappointed? When our marriage, when our jobs, when our money doesn't bring us happiness, who do we get angry at? God. Right? Things didn't do it. You know? God, where were you? Why did you let things happen like this? Why is my marriage like this? Why did I lose my job? Why don't I have money? Why didn't they do this? And we get mad. If you're a good God, you wouldn't have done this. So, I'm not going to serve you. Good excuse, right? I don't have to obey you because you're a cruel God. You're not a good God. Understand that God, in His severe mercy, will allow difficulty and hardship in order to cause us to realize the only source for life, for happiness, for contentment, for fruitfulness, is not in the things of this world, but is in Him, in a relationship with Him. With a sticker in our mouth, We don't realize that, right? With a pacifier in our mouth, we don't realize that we're starving to death, right? And God is loving enough in His severe mercy, in His great love. Suffering. You say suffering. How can you account for that? How could God allow a little child to wrongfully be victimized? What kind of a God is that? What kind of a terrible, wretched, despot God would do that? The same terrible God, the same God that killed His own Son for me. In His love, God knows that the hope for you in eternity, and this does not validate anybody inflicting suffering on any child or any victim or victimizing anyone. But God did not forget you. God did not leave you there. God did not busy somewhere else. God was not punishing you as a little child. God, in His severe mercy, was allowing the things of this world to cause you to cry out to Him. And you've got one of two choices. Will you harden your heart, as Pharaoh did? Or you respond and say, God, You are the source of life. You are the source of joy. You are the source of happiness. Most people do what? Harden their hearts. God allows that, knowing this is your hope. I am willing to let you suffer for the time in order to have eternity with Me in a right relationship with Me. Because you're going to have to make a choice here, bud, who you'll serve. You're going to have to make a choice here if you honor Me as God. And when all those things that are good, you know, all those why couldn't I have been one of those lives where I had a silver spoon in my mouth? Well, God realized I probably wouldn't realize a need for Him. I probably wouldn't realize that I have a desperate need for God to make me happy. I would have said, nah, a little more will make me happy. You know what kind of car I can get next year when I get that check, man? I can get a Ferrari and I'll be really happy. Right? Turbo Razor. I'll be really happy. Okay? No. God says, in the severe mercy, I will let you go through hard times. I will let you suffer because I love you. In the same way that the people of Israel suffered, right? I mean, there's some of the plagues that are going to come up that God excluded them just to show, this is about, these are My people, and these aren't. So I would cause us all, I would encourage us all, to, you know, something hopefully we talk more about with the guys, you know, on Thursday night. We did last year, and it'll be good to get those lists out, right? What do those look like? You know, where did we end up? You know, did we have goals that aligned themselves with God's heart? Did our lives produce things that were valuable for the kingdom? Or am I serving the wrong gods? Am I serving false gods? And to think arrogantly that we don't do that is to be a fool. And to be sucked into the vortex of hell. Because the enemy will impersonate. He will impersonate with power. We just say, oh, if something's miraculous, that must be from God, right? Really? Did you not? I didn't make that story up. You read it right here. This is a word of God. The magicians replicated it. Supernatural. And doing it. In order why? To harden the people of Egypt's hearts. To cause them not to honor God as God. And He does the same thing these days. Still, He is alive and well on planet Earth, replicating the nature and character of God for the purpose of taking you to hell and destroying our life. Who do we serve? Who is the God we serve? Does it align with this? Does our life align with looking for our hope and our joy and our peace and our life and our fulfillment? You know, anybody who looks at their marriage and says, marriage will make me happy, you're going to be very disappointed. Okay? Period. Now, let me just say, 40 years into it, and the hardest thing I've ever done, there's the greatest joy I love my wife and am more in love with my wife than I've ever been. I'm doing it. It's a wondrous thing. I like spending time with her and stuff. Novel concept. Okay? But it's still hard. It was hard. It's always been hard. To think that that's where... And you know what? You know where my joy came from? Obedience. You know the fulfillment in our marriage came from? Obedience. The success of our marriage, you know where it came from? From honoring, looking at marriage and thinking marriage was going to make me happy? No, we got over that pretty quick. To looking to God and saying, I will be obedient to you, God, and watching Him bless our lives. Watching Him bring the water of the Nile, the richness of the things of this world, and fulfill us. Watch Him bring fruitfulness, you know? The God, that, it's funny that God, when you read about that God Hecate, the frog face one, you know? It was the God of the frogs. There was a direct relationship. It was the God of the third term trimester. You know, a terrible place to be, kind of. But still, he was the God of productivity and fruitfulness. I mean, they looked for it in fertility in birth doing it. We see that quite different. We are quite skewedly different. It used to be that children were seen as a blessing from God on doing that. We don't see it so much that way for a whole lot of whatever reasons doing it. But... you know, I look at that and say, okay, I could have worshipped the frog face, looking for a way for success and for happiness and fruitfulness in my life, or be obedient to God. And now I look at my children who are having children and blessing us greatly in that process. You know, not because of my goodness, because I realize that that fruitfulness, that productivity, that health of a family isn't going to come from me. It's going to come from me being obedient to God and Him blessing us. And us. And that's true for all of you and your families. Let's pray. God, none of us want to go through the plagues of Egypt. None of us want to have our... what we see is our source of life and happiness and community and partying and good food and all those things bring fullness of life. We don't want those crushed. We don't want those to stink and to be destroyed. None of us want to go through it. None of us want to go through what we set up as being our sign of success, our sign of fruitfulness, our sign of productivity. We don't want those crushed. We don't want to go through that pain. We don't want to go through that suffering. We don't want that pile of dead frogs in our life. But I thank you that you love us enough in your mercy that you will do that to show that you are who you are. That you are the God, that you are the source of life. And when we look for it anywhere else, when our life is not 100% committed to finding the fullness of life through you, we're idolaters. We are worshiping other gods. And you're very clear here when Moses goes in the mountain, you shall have no other gods before me. You're a jealous God. You don't share the throne, the worship of our lives with others, with other gods. So I ask that you would clarify in us as we began a new year. I know it's a pretty perverse thing in our culture. I mean, the whole New York Times Square thing, and what a joke. It's not about partying and celebration. It's about looking forward, I think, to a coming year. What will this look like? How will I be more a man or a woman of God? How will I be a better, more obedient to you in my parenting, in my marriage, in my service to the community, my job, and my service to the people that you bring me in contact with? And what are the idols that keep that from happening? What are the false gods that we serve? You were very clear to say, there'd be no other gods before me. The people for generations had grown up with hundreds of gods that were all there for different purposes and different reasons and different things. You say, I am who I am. The only true and living God. The great and mighty I am. And there is no one worthy of glory and worthy of worship than you. So God, I ask that you would stir all of our hearts to take a sober look in the next few days, as this is a cultural time when we kind of reflect on a new year and a new start and what will this look like. And, you know, it's number one on the calendar, but cause it to be more than that in this period of time in our life, that we will willing to look in the mirror clearly to face who's really there and what we really are and who we really are, and realize you want us to suffer, that you are willing because you love us. Cause us to be willing to, not to avoid pain and sorrow, because you say there will be pain and sorrow, but to enjoy the futility of the wasted life, wasted time, destruction that the enemy uses us to perform in this world on our children and our spouses and the people around us. Saying that we serve you and yet our lives reflect and show something completely different to the world around us, and that's a lie about you. So God, causes us to see clearly. Causes us to reflect that hard times and suffering that you allow because you love us, because you want us to cry out to you, to realize our need for you. That's because you're a loving Father. Jesus, I thank you for allowing us. This is a time where we have celebrated. Don't let us put Christmas away until next year. This is a time when you intervened. We celebrate your intervention in this world as a savior of this world. And I thank you for that. I thank you that we can come in your goodness and your righteousness, because otherwise ours is filthy rags. Amen.